Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, media, culture, politics, and everything in between. My name's Chris, and for a twist, I'm in Washington, D.C., visiting one of my very best friends, Jason, who's also here.
Great to have you here, Chris.
And Trisha, who's missing all the fun by being in L.A.
Hello.
We're having a great time, by the way. Sorry that you're missing out.
It is a little weird. Like, I'm across from Chris. Do I look at him through the computer? Do I look at him in person? Like, I see his screen. It's like I'm in like a hall of mirrors.
We need to lock eyes for the totality.
I'm going to intimidate you to my point of view
for the entire time. So
just stare longingly in his eyes.
You know, I haven't been down to D.C. and Jason and I were trying to figure it out. It's been 12
years. When did you get there?
I got here last night. Yeah, it's been
This comes out of nowhere. I really didn't know this was a part of your plan.
You texted me like two, 3 days ago.
Because I figured this out like last week. But also, not for nothing, Jason secreted over to L.A. and I just saw pics of you guys and no one told me, so.
Is that a verb you can use like
secreted?
That?
Secreted? Yeah. It sounds gross, right?
Yes, it does.
You know what? I suspect that's not true.
It's like the second definition.
I don't think there's any relationship between the adjective secret.
Secret as a secrete is different than secret.
That's what I'm saying, and I don't think secret is ever a verb. Secreted to L.A.
You know what? I still stand by the fact that you secreted over to.
Right. I mean, it sounds very poetic in a gross kind of way. So
I needed all the stuff. There's a lot of things. I'm not comfortable.
I do like that we assign like a few minutes of every podcast to talk about language. It's great.
It is.
It's the fifth topic that we discuss.
Maybe it is actually a list.
So, Trisha, what's going on in L.A.? What's going on in the streets of L.A. that we need to know about?
I don't know, actually. I'm heading out of it. I'm taking a road trip.
Where are you going?
Gonna go to Sedona, actually.
Oh, nice. Sedona, Arizona.
Yeah, it's supposed to be quite nice, and I have a friend whose boss has a home there, so we're gonna stay there. And it's I think 2 hours from the Grand Canyon. I've never been, so
I've always wanted to go.
I've done that trip. I've done Sedona.
Have you done?
To Grand Canyon? Sedona
is it nice?
Sedona is amazing. It's just like one of those physical places that you're like, I can't believe this exists. Like, I've been to a few places like that. Like, it's just like, it was not in my imagination that a place existed like this. That's how I would describe Sedona.
I have no context for it other than the fact that I've heard it's a gorgeous place. I'm just looking forward to it.
What Jason's saying is what I've heard. I've heard, like, it's the kind of thing you go to and then, like, you're changed.
Yeah. And, like, the Grand Canyon. I mean, I'm really glad I went there. It is amazing. It's huge. But it's kind of, I feel like there's some movie, is it Vacation? There's some movie where, like, you see them go to the Grand Canyon, and they're like, well, how long do we stand here?
The Chevy Chase movie.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that one, but again, I'm really glad I went. It is amazing. But it's kind of like you've seen pictures, you've heard about it. But
yeah,
Sedona's like this, like, sleeper hit, where it's like, and I'm serious, like,
you know what?
And you know, without even seeing a sign, you know, and I won't spoil it, but you know when you've hit it, and it's like, holy shit.
What's going on in Sedona?
Just visually.
It's visually beautiful.
It's
unbelievable. That's exactly what happened, because our plan was, let's just go to the Grand Canyon, and somebody actually said the exact same thing to us. Somebody said, I don't know if you want to build an entire trip around that.
I've never been to the Grand Canyon, but I will say, how is that?
Yeah.
I feel like everyone says it's the kind of thing that once you're there, it makes sense why you need to go there, or it's just more beautiful than you can imagine.
Oh, sure. But then you're thinking to yourself, how long am I going to stand here? It's kind of like when I saw the Mona Lisa. I was like, this is smaller than I expected.
I didn't even look at the Mona Lisa when I was there. You know,
exactly.
I was like, oh, there
you
it is.
Roll up in it, and it's behind glass, and there's an entire crowd.
And people are like clawing each other like it's a zombie movie to see it. And I'm like, you've seen it. What's the attraction here?
And you actually get a much better look on the internet than you do in person.
You can't even see it in person. I have pictures of the crowd that I took watching the Mona Lisa And I don't know the way they're expecting her to move. It was stupid.
That's anyway. So meta-artistic of you.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know.
Picture of crowd looking at Mona Lisa.
I'm a meta-artist. Also, by the way, verb, secret. One, transitive, to make or keep secret. Two, transitive, to hide secretly, as in the sentence, he was so scared for his safety, he secreted arms around the house. Secret is a verb. Bam! Thanks.
Wow.
Thanks, Wiktionary.
The master's degree in English has just been humbled.
I know. I've there you go. Humbled. See?
Who has a master's degree in English?
I do.
It's hard to tell. Yeah.
Yeah, clearly. Sorry, you Penn. I just outed you into doing a terrible job educating your master's student.
No, but you know what I was thinking? What is up with these like English majors being sort of radicalists? I was like, oh, you're
what
English
are you talking
major?
About?
I know another English major, and he has interesting, intriguing political ideas, and it must be all the books you all read, I guess.
Or maybe just the people you know, Trisha.
There's something there, and there have been things written about this. So,
yep,
yeah, I think it is true that a lot of Marxist scholars, thinkers, activists, there was a point, I don't know, 60s or something, when they like descended upon universities, especially in history and English departments.
Which makes sense.
And so, like, post-colonial theory, Marxist theory. I mean, when I went, it was interesting because people asked me about Penn, and I'm like, it was actually, on the whole, like, if I think about my roommates and people, like, I met socially, I was surprised at how conservative it was. And I mean that politically and not in the worst sense. But then the English department, which was a separate building, Bennett Hall, like, on the eastern border of the campus, was, like, a totally Marxist, post-colonial, you know, critical theory. And so it was like completely the world I was in when I was in class versus when I got home to the apartment I shared with three other guys who were engineering students was like totally different. It was like a very, not 100%, but a very Marxist department.
Interesting.
Fascinating. Well, I mean, not so surprising because I know that a lot of the things that have kind of animated the right has been sort of what's been going on in English departments.
That's right.
According to them, that's been like where American like academia has gone wrong is all of the radical things that have been happening in departments.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. One last piece about this, like, so just very recently, it's just interesting we're talking about this now. So there's a guy that I know well. We sit on a couple boards together. He's a Republican, fiscal conservative, great guy. We disagree on a lot of politics, but like we're both very passionate about social justice, that kind of thing. He forwarded me this article, and I don't remember who wrote it, about it was a conservative bemoaning that universities, like that basically there are like almost no conservative voices on most universities anymore. And I actually think it's true. And he was making two points, one of which I agreed with and one of which I disagree with. One was that, you know, students are not being exposed to a range of ideas. And I think that that's a very fair point. but the other point was then he was saying he was tying that to like the you know the argument going on about like free speech on campuses and that student organizations are the stuff we've talked about that like and my pushback to this friend of mine was like I'm not sure that I agree that there's a complete connection there like I didn't feel like the professors I had were influencing me to like not hear conservative ideas or like ban ideas.
What would a conservative voice sound like in a college context? I mean, and I don't mean to be cynical or just like anti-conservative, but education itself is not a conservative concern.
Activity, no.
Am I right? So
I actually disagree with that.
So I mean, if you're in a conservative class, I don't know what you're talking about other than obscuring knowledge. I mean, and again, maybe that's really super anti-con, but
we have a big conservative.
What's a conservative take on history? Like, let's talk about a conservative take on American history.
The conservative take is
we glorify the Europeans, and we further denigrate the people. Like, what does that look like?
Not necessarily.
Does this count as a topic?
It seems like, I don't know whose it is, but okay.
All right, well, let's wrap this up because I'm curious. Go ahead.
Part of why I think you're asking the question the way you are is that, unfortunately, conservative these days, there's a high equivalency between conservatism and, like, supremacy or chauvinism or whatever. But look, there are conservatives who, and again, this friend of mine I would put in this category, you know, I think a conservative take on history is that the free market was a liberating force for the working classes and the oppressed classes of Europe. The United States contribution was democracy, getting rid of a monarchy. I mean, there's a lot of that's like not, you know, and I think a conservative who is sensitive to social justice issues the way that we are would say, you know, yes, like slavery was terrible and there were terrible things going on, but gradually the free market and the free exchange of ideas and democracy and the Constitution have led to a gradual equalization of or towards equalization of women and minorities. And
see, but that's not necessarily a conservative point of view. Like, that's just a sort of a neutral view of history. All that stuff is true, right? There's just context missing.
Well, I think
you can add the context and still have those things be true. So it's one thing to say that, yes, you know, maybe the free market had an influence in the abolition of slavery, but there was also other things, such as like domestic and international pressure, right? The growing recognition that black people were people, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think so. A conservative point of view is everything you're saying and just none of the others, which to me is not an education.
No,
you can make the point that if your friend was saying that there's a conservative voice missing, I mean, I think the real point he's trying to make is that there's conservative ideas missing, or that the liberal education is lacking, which I would probably agree with.
I'm sorry, that is what I meant.
Okay,
just the distinction I want to draw, though, is that where the disagreement would be between, and obviously we're generalizing here, but between a conservative scholar on the issues we're talking about and some of the professors I had at Penn, mm-hmm. is that, like, I had a professor at Penn that we would read romantic poetry, and every time we went through a poem,
you told me about this.
He would say, now, they're talking about the greatest evil in the world, which is, of course, marketplace capitalism. Now, he would say that every class. And, you know, there are plenty of readers of romantic poetry who like it just as much, who would say, I don't think this is an indictment of marketplace capitalism. Like, you don't need to be a social, like, so that's where
okay.
there would be a disagreement.
Obviously, but that's like that professor's spin on that. You know, professors
no,
are
I,
always injecting their personal
stuff. Right, but I would say, and again, I think I got a great education at Penn. The English department was heavily Marxist. I mean, I think we were frequently looking at literature from various ages mm-hmm. through a Marxist lens of saying, mm-hmm. well, what are the economic conditions that are causing, you know, this artistic expression? And it's just a conservative professor who might like the literature just as much would not see it that way. They'd be more interested in, you know, what does this mean about the ideas of the time? Or it's just a different lens.
I'll agree that maybe departments are not hiring conservative voices. And I think that is a shame, because I think you should have people
and
there.
That's where I agree.
Because you need people to push back on,
yeah.
for the students to push back on, but also for the faculty to push on each other.
Agreed.
Because that's where you get, you know, it's through the conflict you're going to get different points of view. So that's fine, but...
That's right.
But what if your ideas are shrouded in evil? But anyway.
And back to judgmental liberal people.
And we're back to...
Well, you know why? You know what it is? It's because I'm having an issue with this. I was at an event recently. And, you know...
You made that sound very, very dodgy.
I know.
Yeah.
We were mostly clothed.
And mostly clothed. No, but it came up that somebody was, had a friend of a friend who was voting for Trump. And so I said, oh, so she's a racist. And, and of course, that's a horrible thing to say. But I said, you know what, listen, at this juncture, because of your party's platform and because of who's the head of your party, I'm just going to call a spade a spade. Now, you could be a conservative or you could be a Republican, but you should be sort of distraught at your party's platform. You should, you know, like there are valid conservative ideas that doesn't have to fall into a space where it's xenophobic, racist, sexist, or any of those other isms,
however,
right?
However, you know, two episodes ago, Jason talked about the power of persuasion and what Trump does. You were talking about the Dilbert creator who talked about this, like what Trump does is very successful. And one of the things is that he labels people, so like Crooked Hillary or was it Goofy Elizabeth, so you can't think about them otherwise.
Slash Pocahontas.
Yeah, that's the thing that we do. When someone says, I support Trump, and you go, oh, so that you're a racist, that's what we're doing, right? We're trying to associate racism with Trump.
Why wouldn't we associate it? That is the platform.
Because
Christopher, are we disagreeing with his platform?
No,
is his platform not racist, anti-Semitic recently?
You know what I'm saying?
No, you don't like me calling these people racist because it seems dismissive. But you know what it is? It's not dismissive because it's actually their platform. I mean, they had legitimate conservative candidates with conservative ideas that completely lost out to a raving lunatic.
I feel like I can't win this one because I wasn't prepared for this because we're still talking about a topic. However, I will say, I would state it like this. Not that people who support Trump is racist or that the platform is racist, but Trump's platform lacks any substance other than xenophobic comments that he's made, which, I mean, I guess by definition it is racist, but I just think the Republican
platform
and by the way, the Republican platform is different from Trump and his blatherings.
Like very much.
They have an official platform, which is informed by the nominee and vice versa. At least that's the way it should go when things are in a normal year when everyone hasn't lost their minds. Sucks for Republicans who might want to see that platform enacted. They know Hillary's not going to enact it, and it's a 50-50 if Trump will, because and so that's the bind they find themselves in. So this was all part of the intro, everybody.
Theme song, come now.
I know.
your editing job is going to be very painful, but we're going to get through this
so
quickly.
I'm just going to jump into my topic because I think it's probably less. It's less full bodied than yours. What I wanted to talk about was the Pope. Recently, the Pope,
party of pedophiles.
Oh, I'm getting to that, of course.
Trisha, you are just on it. You are ready for a show on MSNBC. You are just Trisha, like, Trump, racist. Pope, party of pedophiles. Oh. Like, you got the alliteration
you know
going,
what,
like,
though?
You are ready.
You know what, though? I can't find the lie. But anyway. So,
I'm gonna be nice.
Pope was asked recently something about Orlando, and the Pope made gestures to indicate that, I don't know the quote, but what he said was that Christians should actually apologize to LGBT people for X, Y, and Z and all the terrible stuff that happened, or not apologize, but seek forgiveness from God for some of the actions. And then as queer people are wont to do, or queer people who are religious, they immediately like took to Twitter and Facebook and posted and said, oh, this Pope, he's the best Pope we've ever had. You know, long live the Pope, and pictures of the Pope overlaid with a rainbow filter. And and this is less of a topic. I just kind of want to rant and then have you guys write back.
And then we'll just do our topics. Just
so, yeah, the one thing, this bothers me so much, because if any secular organization started where the Catholic Church seems to be indicating they want to go, we would decry them as being hopelessly behind the times, right? Their ideas about women, their ideas about queer people, but yet, When the Pope seems to indicate in public that queer people should not be strung up and crucified, you know, the LGBT community is like, oh my God, he's advancing the Catholic Church. No, he's not. Listen, everyone within the reach of my voice, the Catholic Church will not advance ever under any circumstances because that's not what churches do, right? Basically what he's saying is that gay people should not be persecuted in public as an activity, which is the barest thing you can say about anybody, right? That's the least thing you could say. That's like me saying, I'm for women's rights. I advocate that they should not be sexually assaulted or domestically abused in public as an activity. That's what I'm coming down on, which is like the least that I can say. What is your viewpoint on, and I want to talk about queer people, but also women, why is it that LGBT people are constantly looking to the Pope and religious institutions to change to include them? I feel like if you treat your religion like a Chinese menu, like, oh, I want this, but none of this, and this, and none of that, at what point is it just not the religion, and you're just further, just make up your own. It's all made up anyway. What difference does it make, right? Someone, give me your viewpoint.
You're welcome to go first on this one, Trisha.
Wait, so what is your resistance to the idea that a religion, which is a human offering, by the way. It's not spiritual. It's not, doesn't have any context with God at all. It's a man-made thing. No, I mean, in the sense that...
It sounds like you're asking a question, but also making a statement.
Just a bit of a commentary. Do you have an opinion on this, Trisha? I can't tell.
Well, in the sense that there are, like these behaviors are codified by human beings, not by God, right? So at any point in time, your religion can shift up if it wants to, Christopher. And I guess that's why those people are looking towards the Pope as the leader of the church. Because if you really believed in anything, you'd be like, well, you're clearly not the leader of the church. God is. But no, he's the human leader. So he has to take human considerations under advisement and then make recommendations. Like, for example, the Pope is considered slightly radical in his sort of environmentalist viewpoint, which if you were to go back to any old popes, those ideas would be far-fetched. So clearly there can be evolution in the church, and that's the expectation. Do you see what I mean?
Sure.
That's why they're pushing back on, or like, you know, like female priests, or so these things can be modified, even if the ideology might have to be tweaked to make it make sense, no?
But then at what point do you depart from it being a codified religion? At what point do you decide, you know what I mean? Like,
well, the religions do that constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens all, like what you just described as a Chinese menu,
yeah,
that is how religions get started, and that's how they develop, and that's how they evolve. You know, the Catholic Church say, I don't disagree with anything you said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much of their viewpoints are outdated and inhumane, but it has changed. And all religions have changed. I mean, you can make an argument that Islam actually advanced previously and now has gone back.
Mm-hmm. I can't make that claim. I don't know about Islam, but... Okay.
Well, there are people who make that claim, and of course, with all of this, there are... Especially with Islam, actually, you know, there are different types of Islam. The Catholic
mm-hmm.
Church is an enormous institution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think where... The way I see it, Chris, is like, yes, I agree that where the Catholic Church is starting from is so far behind what's acceptable generally. That said, you have this enormous institution that has tremendous amount of influence on the way millions, I mean hundreds of millions of people see the world and behave. And so, you know, I agree with, like, let's say your frustration, and I agree with, like, the double standard, for lack of a better term. That said, if we look at the church, it's here. It exists. It influences all these people. And prior to this pope, the things that popes have said and not said and done and not done have perpetuated and exacerbated so much of intolerance, inequality, abuse. I mean, we could go on and on.
Let's talk about abuse in the Catholic Church.
But looking at this pope and hearing the things he's saying, like, they are advancement, and I think there's evidence that he is having an impact of moving people's thoughts forward, creating space for Catholics who have always been more tolerant but have not been accepted. You know, it's not been, like, okay publicly to be more tolerant. I'm reminded of conversations we had previously about, you know, it's frustrating that it takes white people to die from heroin before it's noted in an epidemic. That said, things get better when white people, when there's general consensus that it's an epidemic, they get better for everyone. And I would take that as a win here.
I agree. I think that's exactly what's happening. Now, the other thing I will point out to you, Chris, and I think this is a very valid resistance on your part, is that what the Pope says in public and what he actually institutionalized in documents that are written down are very different. So there's this notion that this Pope is like a feminist, but he's actually been quite resistant to religious females in written documents and in actual things that will be executed. So it's similarly, you know, like, I think this Pope is also really good at PR, better than
the last Pope looked like fucking the Emperor from Star Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, every moment he's going to shoot lightning out of his fucking fingertips.
We all have to be very wary of what people say publicly and how they actually are going to institute changes within the organizations that they actually lead.
Okay.
Because leading with a gentle message is one thing, but actually executing it in practice.
Exactly. I agree with both of you. Like, this Pope has been great for PR. To Jason's point, he's changing hearts and minds and maybe having people be less cruel, which is great. However,
personally, I love that in my religious book.
What frustrates me is that I think a lot of queer people are waiting for their invitation to the church.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a party that you'll never be invited to, because although inside the party they can be like, don't be mean to the people outside, they still don't want you at the party, and that is not going to change.
Just one exception, that one I can think of, Episcopal Church.
Okay, I'm talking about the Catholic Church.
Okay, all right. I mean, you were saying religions.
Okay, no, I'm talking about the Catholic Church.
But we have seen it, and I don't know. I mean, is it possible, since we've seen it in the Episcopal Church, that we'll eventually see it in the Catholic Church?
Okay, I'm going to go on record. I'm going to say a lot of stuff. I apologize to my family, because I know you listen to this, but here it goes. All of religion is made up, right? So I can decide today. And Jason and I had this lengthy conversation about if Jesus was even real, like historically. We're not sure, and we're smart people. So, I mean, it's all made up. You can say whatever you want. So I can be like, oh, I want God to accept me, and wake up the next morning and be like, hey, he does. I had a vision or whatever the
people
bullshit.
People do that all the time.
Sure.
I know lots of people.
Why not?
Have done that.
Just make it up. But, like, let's say I was raised Catholic and I'm gay, and I spend my entire life lamenting that the church won't accept me, rather than just join one of the other bullshit ones, Episcopalian, Unitarian, you know, whatever, the Church of Holy Light. Look, I just made one up. You know,
you know why you can't. You know why it won't. Why that won't happen? The same reason why the gay community wanted marriage.
Go on.
Not some equal partnership or some other name, because what they want is full acceptance in the community, in the tradition,
civilly,
in the organization.
Doing that is like a municipal body. Like, our government is so different.
Well, but Chris, what I would say, look, you're a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You've been a therapist. It's just like, I think there's something deeply human about, like, psychologically, this is who we are, for better or for worse. You know, it's like I'll give an example. Like, I know someone who, his father has not been around his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the age of 2, his mother married another man who has been all in, father figure, good relationship, and yet the issue that his biological father, you know, skipped out, continues to be like an enormous thing in his life. And so, you know, I have not had that experience, so I look at it and I'm like, I don't really get it. Like, you're getting all this love and all the things you would want from your biological father, from this stepfather you've known since you were 2, almost like your entire remembered life.
Mm.
But that's a deeply human thing, right? Like, there's something about, I originate from this, and so I keep going to that well to get accepted, to get the water, to get the fulfillment, even if there are wells all around me. And we, I think we do this with our families. I mean, I know lots of people that, like, their family has been totally awful to them for whatever reason, and they just keep, I'm just trying to get my mom to see, I'm just trying to get them to like me, I'm just, and it's like...
And this is the thing, if that was a patient of mine who came to see me for therapy, the entire work would be about letting that go. Because you're being ridiculous,
right?
And you're engaging in self-harm, like you want to revisit this pain, and there's no reason to do it.
I'm
and
hearing that's a where I am. Practice developing that you could start,
but
particularly
is,
for LGBT people to let go of your church.
I mean,
I think it's a great tagline.
I just don't
let go,
go
of
your
church.
Like,
you can't say that.
Guess what? I just did.
You know why? Because the question. Let's go backwards. Why do you want to be a part of the church in the first place?
Because
let's ask the why.
I get it, because there's a lot of psychological bullshit that goes in with as far as like the higher power, but also
sense of belonging,
but also the community, the sense of belonging, brotherhood.
Yeah, I need you to dial it back a little bit.
I'm going to need you to dial it back.
I get what you're saying. Why do people join a church? Okay, so people join for community, for brotherhood, for unity. I understand that. And also for the...
from God. And basically to be told that their life matters by some greater being.
That's right.
So to have a church and to have the thing that's the only institution we have on offer, right, that says that there's something more out there. We've left that to churches, not philosophers anymore.
And American Idol.
Yeah, but
although that's
possibly,
over, so.
Possibly, yeah.
But
you know, the church is the place where it says there's more to you than what you make, who you are on the outside, all those other things. This is supposed to be something about your soul. So for you to be fundamentally rejected by an organization that's supposed to be about your soul, I mean, just think about that.
I know.
That's really powerful. Do you know what I mean? And so that is why that dance will always happen. That dance is always going to happen because people want to be found to be a child of God. That's what they want.
When you say it, I think I just heard it for the first time.
Good job, Trisha. Point, Trisha.
However.
However. The clause being disputed.
You know me. I'm just super practical, right? This is what you know. I'm super practical, and I spend exactly zero time asking people to accept me, right?
Yep.
I'm just not interested in that. So obviously that influences my view here. But my thing is, like, if you were raised Catholic and the Catholics won't accept you, just join another fucking church. What difference does it make? Right?
No, because
because God is there too. The brotherhood, unity is there.
You know what? You know why? Because it's one of those things. I mean, I remember reading something from the Dalai Lama, because you know everybody loves the Dalai Lama. But one of the things the Dalai Lama says
is not great on queer issues.
And a lot of issues. But one of the things that the Dalai Lama says is that you kind of have to sit with the one that you came with. You know, you got to. I mean, so even though you might find Tibetan ideas intriguing or blah 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 ideas intriguing, and it's great if you're able to sort of live your life and sort of have those ideas resonate and make sense, but he's really an advocate for you finding space in the religion that you were reared in.
I've read that from him. It's an interesting case.
That's a very big thing for him, but I understand why, because realistically it is the umbrella under which you came up, and so I think a lot of the ideas will be resonant to you, and so you will always, in some sense, maybe potentially feel like a foreigner in the other religion. So I think that's why people don't just go, hey, I'm going to shift gears and move over to here. I mean, it's similar to Jason's metaphor, or I guess his example, which is that, you know what, it's nice that I have this great family that I've chosen, and they're wonderful, but damn, the family that birthed me, that's the one I want.
Thank you for this, because this was helpful in exploring viewpoints that I'll dismiss later. But
you haven't dismissed them yet? However,
I
thought that was the dismissal.
I'm swishing them around my mouth like a fine wine that I'll spit out for another tasting of something else.
That was a good one.
But I will say, I was watching clips from, you know, the seminal Paris is Burning. If you've not seen it, see it. Which is about...
Do I have to see the first one first?
No, Paris is Burning. It's a movie.
No, but wasn't
well,
it
I appreciate
movie?
You doing the recommendation mid.
Sorry.
I know, I'm doing... Well, this isn't a recommendation. This is just something that everyone should have done by now. So,
hey.
This is a reprimand, not recommendation.
Paris is Burning is a documentary about queer people of color in New York in the early and mid-80s.
Yeah.
And it's real exploration of that culture. It is incredible. It's incredible just because of the subject. It's not a lot of that. You don't see that a lot anymore, especially. But anyway, I was reminded of a scene of that when I think it was Pepper LaBeija was saying how a lot of young gay people have come to him and want to call him mother or call him father, right? This is the whole culture of drag mothers and drag fathers because their families have been so rejecting. And the thing, as a queer person, I know is that I've had to build my family from people that I met and people I love, like you two, right? Because I mean, I don't have this experience. Everyone in my family is fine. But as a queer person, like instinctively, I've known that for a long time, that I have to find people and name them my family and stick with them. I guess what's shocking to me about this is that I understand that as a queer person, and these are queer people who are constantly seeking affirmation from the church, when I'm certain they've had to do the same thing as far as, like, the family thing.
Yep.
And so I just don't know why they can't apply, you know, their strength in one area to another. That's my reaction. So that's it. But thank you guys for talking it through with me. And again, I'll ignore most of it. But anyway, who wants to go next?
I need your help if I'm going to go next.
Okay.
Remind me, did we end up having a discussion on our podcast about college campuses? Did it make it in? We did. I thought it might have been one of our early conversations.
I brought it up. I think we had an entire episode about
one
college.
One of our first aired episodes should we be sending kids off to college?
That was my point. Is that why are we sequestering off people with very poor judgment together? Yeah.
Well, I want to revisit that topic.
Sure, I love it.
The reason why I want to revisit it is because I recently watched a documentary called The Hunting Ground, which is devastating. Devastating documentary. And essentially, the documentary is an exploration of campus rape and what universities fail to do on campuses after a rape occurs. So, because essentially the primary concern of the university is not the student or the safety of the student, it is about the reputation of the campus. And interestingly enough, I think one of the lawyers for one of the victims in the documentary essentially stated that pretty much outright, that the university's mandate is to make sure that the university itself is protected. And even though you're a member of the university because you've paid to be there, your protection is not its primary concern. It is the legacy and the longevity of the university that's their concern. And so their interest is in making sure that campus rape is not reported, is not even conceived of as campus rape. And so these women who have been, and men, who have been raped on campus, it's essentially like ducks in a pond. Like, you can do whatever you want, and it is highly unlikely that anyone will see any time in jail. The most that will happen and has happened is that you will be asked to write a paper about your rape.
Oh, my God.
It's devastating. And so, you know, really it's basically an exploration of a couple of victims who basically took it upon themselves to figure out how to hold universities accountable for rape. And so it raised the question to me again that this documentary is a really good support for our initial question, which is, why are we allowing universities to exist in this space? In some weird way, you have this kind of sovereign space in the middle of cities.
I spoke about this before. I think it's a really bad idea, and I'm not sure why laws stop at a university's borders. Like, if a rape happens at New York University, it happened in New York City, you know, and it doesn't matter if I'm in a university building or in the middle of Washington Square Park. I don't get that. You know, the way that you're talking about this documentary, The Hunting Ground, which I want to see immediately now, when you think about it, it really is terrifying. Like, if I was a sexual predator, that's the best place for me to go. Like, and by design.
By design. Because your safety, I mean, Jason, I definitely want to hear, because I'm somewhat confused about, I feel like this is a little bit of a blind spot that we've just kind of missed.
It's really helpful hearing you articulate it, Tricia, because when we've talked about this in the past and when I've thought about it, I feel like my feelings and ideas about it were not fully formed, and I feel like you've just helped me put some ideas together that now make a lot more sense to me, which is that any institution, its primary objective is its own self-preservation. That's just a fact. Catholic Church, university, that's just a fact. And so this is helping me put language to why what you just articulated, Chris, I've always agreed with, which is like, why are, and the federal government did this. I mean, Obama's administration, like, they've really pushed for, like, universities to take on, you know, take responsibility for doing investigations of this and kind of prosecuting it before it gets.
Why? Yeah.
Well, now I can articulate why that is so problematic, because the institution investigating is its number one priority will always be its own self-preservation. And a sex crime being going public, or a sex crime leading to a lawsuit from someone who assaulted someone else, that's always going to be scarier than, like, that's going to be the bigger priority to avoid that than prosecuting the crime. And so now I feel even more strongly, like, law enforcement, that's an institution that is set up for this mission. A university's mission is not to police sex crimes. Like, it's a totally different mission. And so I feel even more strongly now, like, we should not even allow them. Like, so I can say, like, running a public school, if there's an allegation, and you both know this, like, if there's the slightest hint of an allegation that a child's been abused by anyone, whether in the school or outside, I have a legal obligation to call Child Protective Services immediately. You know, I cannot conduct my own investigation. Once I receive it, I must make the call. Universities should be in the same position. There should not even be the opportunity for a university to handle the investigation or prosecution of these sex crimes.
Well, let me ask, while Jason was talking about that, I just did a quick Google search because I had a question, and I started typing, are college professors and Google auto-completed mandated reporters? So happened. So this is a question thousands of people are asking. And I, as a social worker, I'm a mandated reporter. Right. Like any whiff I hear of child abuse, I must ethically report it.
Right. Ethically and legally.
I agreed to do that when I got my degree and my license. But it seems, you know, you run into a problem with college professors is because, yeah. I mean, on one hand, there's safety. The other hand, there's the privacy of the student. But as far as, like, teachers go in that community, I'm not certain. Like, what do you think, Tricia? Would you say that teachers need to be mandated reporters? Like, as soon as they hear or suspect?
College teachers
are saying. Yeah, yeah, because high school and elementary school teachers, they are. By dint of their profession, right? Not their...
Why is that a distinction? Is it because generally they're going to be dealing with underage and these are adults?
I think that's the idea.
I think it's child protective.
But that's the other thing is that mandated reporting, I don't even know if that works for just running those sexual assault. I'm not a mandated reporter. Like if God forbid, one of you came to me and said that you were sexually assaulted, I'm under no ethical obligation to tell anybody. Right? That's a conversation between you and I. So,
but if a child told you, you'd be mandated.
I don't have a choice.
You'd have to.
Okay. Yes.
It's startling to me that if a murder happens on campus, you immediately call the cops, right?
You know what?
It's a murder.
Yes. Question mark.
Well, there are. That's a good. I don't know the answer. But there are universities with campus police that are not actually deputized police, and I don't know at what point. I'm sure there are rules and policies.
But I will say our confusion at this point is upsetting.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, right? it is clear because I think what we're alluding to really is that there is a kind of independence around the law that's clear in our own confusion about this. But I feel like when you're breaking the law, I mean, yes, obviously, if you are dealing with cheating and things that are actually academic crimes. Clearly, I feel like the campus police needs to be intervening on those levels. I mean, drunkenness and all of those things, and maybe. But when it's an actual crime, that it counts as a crime outside a normal life, I feel like the cop needs to trump it. But that's actually not what happens. What happens is that the students are forced or actually compelled to go to the campus police, who, again, they're in the business of protecting the university, not you. They're not thinking about you as a citizen. So in some sense, I'm just like, skip the campus police and drive directly to a hospital so that you can get tested and then immediately alert the cops in the hospital. Because interestingly enough, I think hospital employees are mandated to report.
Yeah, yes, they are.
That's right.
So that's actually, you might have to bypass.
So upsetting.
No, I agree. Because
bypass that university system wholly and go to someplace where mandated reporting actually has to happen.
No, I totally agree. And again, this is really helpful hearing you both because like now I'm at the next stage of how I articulate this. Like, police officer's job is to enforce the law. It's not a university's job. It's not their mission. Mm-hmm. And it's not always in their interest. So if a law has been broken, then that should go to the police, and especially a law that has a human victim. So, yeah, I think universities should not even be allowed to take on this stuff.
And in talking about this, I realize that if I ever had kids, I don't know if I would recommend that they go away to college. I think they would have to stay home or live off campus and attend. Because when you think about it, I don't know why you would put anyone in this situation. It's a terrible situation. I mean, how brave is it? How brave is it of young women to go to these places where effectively, you know, they're prey?
Well, this is the thing that I think that's the thing that the documentary unearths for us.
Jesus.
Is the recognition, because many of the victims, including their parents, are shocked and astonished by the reaction of the university because there were just simply things we took for granted.
Right. There's an expectation.
It was an expectation, and it's not something that you actually. You don't ask yourself that. You just assume you're going to be protected. Right. But what you actually realize is that there's no protection for you. There's not even any requirement for your protection. And so one of the things that actually gets explored in the documentary is how can you hold the university accountable? And I'm not going to give anything away by saying but Title IX is what they settle on. Title IX is the process, is something that they are able to use. Many of the victims work to basically get the Department of Education to bring cases against the university under Title IX protections, which I just think that that's really stunning.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear that, that's frustrating. Like,
yeah, right?
It's weird that, like, you've been a victim of an awful crime, and you're having to invoke Title IX to deal with it. Like, that's crazy.
It's stunning. And so I just think I think it's a wake-up call. And my question then is, like, what are the other institutional spaces that we haven't considered, whether we're protected in those spaces or not?
Church, like I said.
Military.
Church, military, and school.
That's true. It's
the institutions where it's sad. Two of the institutions where we think about sending children and young people. You know, like, places you organize your family around are not safe. Churches are not looking out for your children's best interest, and it seems like colleges aren't either. And the military also has their own ways of dealing.
Their own internal code. I think any organization with its own internal management of rule breakers is a potential snake pit.
So that's it. I think that's what we're talking about. In a sense, and this dehumanizes it a little bit, but what we're talking about is whether you can trust an institution to self-regulate. And I think it's pretty universally true that the answer is always no.
Well, so, but then, from like the constructivist point of view, these choices were made, right? Because they uphold society as it currently stands. So if we decided tomorrow that, sorry churches, sorry military, sorry schools, you are going to be subjected to the same judicial process as any other citizen, and the people associated with you will be subjected to the same judicial process, how would that change society as we know it? Things would look different. What are we looking at?
Think about it. I think that what has
happened... Think about it. I asked the question.
I know. I think what's happened is that it's a holdover, right? I think you've had these historical institutions where we haven't really revisited them in kind of the modern era. And they're monsters now. They're massive institutions bringing in tons of money. And maintaining them is the most important thing for the institutional leadership. However, they have been afforded a public trust that is no longer earned. But their historical preeminence allowed them to have an institutional trust. And we've never actually asked the question, hey, should we be trusting you with our children?
Well, I think to some extent I agree with what you're saying, but there's another factor. I mean, you're asking the question, Chris, what does it look like after?
Mm-hmm.
I think the first question is, how do we get from here to there? The problem is that, first of all, it would require enormous resource allocate. Like, now the government would be on the hook to deal with a lot more stuff than it's had to deal with. And so there's a resource issue, which is, like, I think to some extent the government's like, oh my God, we can't handle all the crazy shit that's happened on your campuses, so you got to deal with it. So that's one problem. The second problem is that these institutions, I mean, Tricia used the term monster. Yeah, they become monsters, and as huge institutions with a lot of resources, they have a lot of lobbying resources. Yeah, so the Catholic Church, the universities, and I've seen this on other issues, I mean, they can deploy a ton of lobbyists. So if, you know, we were going to run for office and introduce a bill to enact what we're saying, it would be a war.
What I'm getting at is trying to, like, draw the sociological lines here, right? To see if what we're asking for is actually what we want. Because if we did do that, right, and we did subject them to the same process as everyone else, it would fundamentally change those institutions. And the question I'm always asking...
How fundamentally?
Well, that's the question, because they exist this way because the way that we live currently is supported by that, right? Right, that's... I can't remember what this theory is called. I think it's constructivist theory. How do social institutions and mores hold us together as a society? If we decided tomorrow that we were going to change all that, we'd think about military, church, and schools differently. They would not exist as they exist currently. You know, so Jason says, like, if the government was like, oh, there's a lot of crazy shit happening on your campus, we're overwhelmed dealing with it, then we would shut schools down. Like, we would change the way colleges work. They could no longer be a thing. And I guess that's what I'm asking, is, like, are we ready for that change? How to get from here to there is an intriguing question, but let's make sure there is somewhere we want to go.
And I think, and I can be kind of an extremist on issues like this.
Yes.
So I'm like, yes, we want to get there. Yeah. Shut them down, like, tear this shit up. Like, I'm always for that. I'm for that radical issue. But that's exactly why there will be such resistance, right? Because, like, if Penn State's like, holy shit, not only could we have bad PR situation on our hands, but we could be shut down – like, God damn, you're dealing with the force of alumni, mm-hmm. and you're dealing with the, you know, leadership, and
Of course it'd be uphill. I mean, what we're talking about is fantastic, right? But I'm just, right I'm, just draw, I'm just drawing
think,
the, I'm just
I'll
drawing
vote
the circle
for yes,
around
we want
it.
To be there.
Sure.
That's my
sure.
vote.
Sure. I'm voting for, I don't know what that would look like. I'm voting for, that would fundamentally change higher ed.
Or
in
I'm
a
voting
way that
for
I hope is beneficial, but it's a flip of a coin.
Or I'm voting for something that's even a middling thing. This is so weird.
Like what?
Because the thing is, part of the reason why universities don't deal with sexual assault on its campus is because they don't want to be the first one to identify that they're rape numbers.
Okay.
But universities are spaces like any other space. And rape happens everywhere.
Right.
So what, I mean, there could just be authenticity in reporting. And part of it is that in some ways they have not been forced to report what actually happens on their campus. Just even if they don't prosecute, which they shouldn't be able to do and all that kind of stuff. But if you are basically just like you have to talk about you now have to talk about graduation rates. You have to talk about the people who are on your campus in terms of like race, sex, whatever. You need to be able to report crime statistics on your campus. Minimally, then you are like an informed consumer when you're going out to purchase an education at a particular university.
I've been beating up a lot on the Obama administration on this issue, and we've all been beating up on the military and that kind of thing. But actually, part of why this conversation is happening, part of why I'm guessing that documentary was made, I do think there have been things put into place where reporting is being forced is maybe too strong a word, but is. My sense is reporting is getting much better. Like, the federal government has put pressure on both the military and universities to report, and we've seen narratives about this. So, like, when they first put those things into place, the military, like, the numbers went up, and then there was this conversation about, like, is there actually all of a sudden more rape? Like, no, people are actually reporting now. So I do think that is getting better. I just want to say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the assumption that you're going to be punished because you are reporting truthfully what's going on your campus is weird and needs to be
right.
challenged.
That's
because,
agreed.
You know what I mean? At the end of the day, it's like, listen, honesty in advertising as much as possible. No. But, you know, I mean, it's just, to me, it just seems like that's why universities are colluding in some sense with the perpetrator. It's because they fear that they're going to lose money. Not in some sense because they even care about the perpetrator. Like, it sounds toxic to say that, but I do think that they're really just simply thinking about their bottom line. And
yeah, no one's sitting around saying we want to be a safe people to rape other people. I don't think anyone's saying that.
I would say that we just need to continue talking about sexual assault and assault against women and men, but this is mostly a problem with young women. I think we need to keep talking about it. I think we need to accept the fact that this happens anywhere, that sexual assault can occur anywhere, and that schools can't make you safe. I think the idea that schools don't want to report their numbers or talk about things happening because they don't want their school associated with a place where young women get raped, well, guess what? Yeah. Young women are getting raped everywhere, and that's the problem. Right. I think we're buying into the fantasy that, like, oh, send your kids to Columbia. Like, our rape numbers are really low. It doesn't happen here. It does happen there.
Right.
And I think that's actually a step that we need to take. And I want to see this documentary because it feels like that's where we're moving to. We just need to talk about this happening. And then maybe we can get – once we get past the idea that some schools are, quote-unquote, better at this than other schools, once we can accept that this is happening, then we can allow schools to take the necessary precautions and steps when it does happen.
So, and now this is going to be a little bit contradictory to what I said before. I mean, I think part of the motivation of, you know, the government saying universities, you have to deal with this, part of it is a resource issue, but part of it is, well, yes, it happens everywhere and it can happen everywhere. Institutions can create cultures that do a better job of preventing things than others. And I think that if there's an argument to be made for why universities should be doing the policing, which I don't agree with, but if there's an argument to be made, it's that if you actually had to deal with it, maybe then you'd feel more compelled to create a culture to prevent it more often. But I think in the final analysis, the costs of that outweigh the benefits, which is that the institution has an incentive not to deal with it. So the ideal, which is not easy to achieve, is that it gets policed by the police. Yes, numbers come out that these things are happening on the campus, and then that becomes what pushes the campus to improve the culture.
Tricia, take the last word on this. Where did you end up with this?
It's an extension of your idea, Chris. Because one of the things I think that really struck me in the documentary were, first of all, the number of universities where these things were happening and the number of universities that had cases, Title IX cases brought against them around sexual assault. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that it was every university. Mm-hmm. Every type of university.
Yeah,
so it's not, you don't know, but you know, when you sometimes you do a documentary and people can immediately be dismissive because it's like, oh, well, they went to some university down right. in Timbuktu. No, mm-hmm. it was all the big ones. Harvard, Columbia, UNC, I mean, all the major ones, and especially the ones with the Big Ten ones with athletic departments, because I didn't even talk about the intersection of that, because mm-hmm. many of the perpetrators were athletes, and so they also received special protection.
Right.
So what was most distressing about it, I think, is part of the idea of the specialness of a campus experience, which is something that we have explored continually, I guess, in our podcast,
yeah.
is this idea that a university setting is supposed to be a place outside of maybe even time, where you're supposed to explore ideas, you're supposed to challenge students. You're supposed to actually expect more from the people in this setting. That was what was most distressing to me, really, as someone I think that had probably bought into that idea, where that was just the sort of disdain from, like, administrators and professors. I mean, these are professors who, you catch them another day, they'd be sort of pitching intellectually stimulating notions. But then when they sort of fell down on rape, that was what was so utterly terrifying, because these are the best and the brightest, and they couldn't offer an ideology around rape that was an advancement on what was doing and what was happening in regular society.
That's very.
That was the. Yeah. You know what I mean? Think it's about
very,
that. Like,
very.
You know?
So we should check out this documentary.
Yeah, I think I have to see it.
Wow, we're making media recommendations left and right. I submitted Paris is Burning, you submitted The Hunting Ground, so we're all doing two recommendations this episode.
Go ahead, Jason.
It's funny you say that, because my topic is going to relate to my recommendation.
Here we go.
Ooh,
what was about to happen now, I realize the way you just framed that, Chris, is I'm going to end up without a fucking recommendation again.
Well, anyway. Talk and think at the same time. Yeah.
Or we might have to just reframe this recommendation.
Yeah. Wait, or you right. could, your topic can lead into your recommendation.
All right. So I'm a big fan of the Diane Rehm Show, which is an NPR show. It's here in D.C., WAMU, but it's syndicated not everywhere, but around the country. Diane Rehm's been doing it for a long time. She's about to retire. She had an interview recently with a guy named Jonathan Rauch, who wrote about and talked about in this interview the fact that basically making the argument that we have made the political establishment and our governing bodies like impossible to work by well-intentioned policy changes. And there are a bunch, but there's one I wanted to explore with the two of you, which is earmarks and what, you know, derisively is called pork. And I've heard other people talk about this, in fact, people who work inside government and lobbyists, that both at the, you know, at the federal level, we've gotten rid of earmarks. So just like a decade ago, it was very common that, you know, there would be these earmarks that the federal government would pass this particular place in this particular state or this particular institution is going to get a big grant. If you recall, during Obama's, I think his first campaign, one of the things they were saying about him was as a senator, he got an earmark for a $300,000 projector at a museum in Chicago. I don't know the facts. We don't need to get into that. But this would happen a lot. I mean, I have to admit, I ran a school where we got an earmark, a federal earmark, and it was very helpful.
Unbelievable.
Thank you, Uncle Sam. But the thing about it is, the reality is, this is how things got done in government. So you'd have, you know, a faction of a party pushing for a policy, and then you'd have someone across the aisle, or maybe even in their own party, saying, I disagree, I'm going to fight it. And so then they'd say, well, look, if you let this go, if you vote for it or at least don't vote against it, we will approve an earmark for you to bring home to your district $100,000 for blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And yeah. that happened all the time. Now, the thing is, because like the example I gave about Obama, I mean, it was both how things got done. It was also, you know, it was seen as really problematic. It was pork. It was like honest graft. It was, mm-hmm. you know, the of certain districts getting resources because if you had a senator or a congressperson that didn't have a lot of ideology, they would just go to town and like bring back the bacon. I mean, I remember people talked about some of our representatives in Maryland. Like, well, he brings back the bacon. Like, I don't know how he votes, but, like, he's bringing back money for... And so, you know, I was one who was like, yeah, we should get rid of earmarks, even though I benefited from one. But now, like, because we don't have that, the government has gotten kind of more ideological, less practical. And so people are getting elected just to fight fights, and things don't get done because nothing's being smoothed out by, like, you vote for this policy, you get money to bring home to your district. And so I found this interview fascinating. I hadn't really thought about it in that way. And he's basically advocating for, like, we've got to put pork back into the system. And I'd love to hear what you guys think about that.
Sounds a little lazy to me, but...
What lazy how? What do you mean?
You know, because it's like, anytime you're attempting to change a system, things will be problematic for quite some time, right? Because it's... Because what you're saying is you can't do business as usual. And you have to come up with a new strategy, a new way of being effective and being and delivering what you promised to your constituents.
It's an interesting point of view you're taking.
You know, because, right, pork was a strategy to get around the fact that maybe people are recalcitrant and they'll never get it. They're never going to change their mind, right?
That's
they're
right.
They're like, let's just use
pork. So I'll just pay you off.
I'll buy you off. And so, I mean, maybe this is an extension from the last topic you had, Jason, last week when you were trying to ask the question about the political process. And maybe this is just, maybe what we have to admit is that this American idea doesn't work. You know,
okay.
Maybe. No, I mean like, you know, but like.
Where do you end
I mean,
up with that?
No, but you know what? You have political revolutions all the time. What I'm just saying is, though, that Maybe we've gotten to a place now where, fine, we can't do the pork anymore. Now we're ideologues, but now we have to say, okay, now even if we're going to be ideologues, how are we going to get something done? I don't think it's time to return to pork. I think it's probably an opportunity to like push the envelope a little bit and challenge it ourselves to do something else.
That's fascinating. What do you think, Chris?
This was a surprise topic, by the way, so I did not have any chance to think about this, Jason.
We're really going to see how smart you are.
I know.
At the dinner last night, I made the comment, Tricia, so we're talking to Jem and Steve about this podcast, which neither of them has even spent a second listening to, and you know, we were just talking, and I was like, you know, most people really like Tricia's ideas, Team Tricia. And I made the comment, I think Tricia's actually the smartest of the three, and Chris lost his shit. Like, oh, my God. It was as if I had, like, directly called him some awful
name. You did! Tricia's not smarter than us.
Is it because I have a vagina? Is it because I have a vagina that I can't be smarter than you?
With your vagina. I'm sure it's wonderful. But the fact is that you're not any smarter than either of us.
She's
pretty
smart, though.
She
totally changed my thinking on it, just like that, and you don't even have a thought.
I was just surprised that Jason himself is Team Tricia. Wait, how does that even work?
No.
Do you have a Team Tricia t-shirt?
Listen, I want you all to have t-shirts, and then when I walk out and all the room is filled with Team Tricia t-shirts, don't get upset with me.
Okay, this is my idea that's forming rapidly.
Cool.
I think... Should we put pork back in? Should we take pork back out? I think literally a government built on bribery is probably not the best way to go, right? That's what we're talking about. I like your idea, like we're challenging people to do something else. Like we want people to rise to the challenge. I'm just wondering, is there another way to incentivize people who are your political opponents to compromise? You know, we use money, but is there another way? You know... I don't know. I'm gonna think upon that. But when you were talking, Jason, I just lament, or maybe I shouldn't lament, because I don't know if there was this bygone era of debate and gentlemanly discourse. The reports that I read from like the 18th centuries that those people were just
crazy.
They were all the Trumps of their
day. Yeah, no
right?
kidding.
They all put out private publications about how so and so was like a dick
and false news.
Literally.
They were just lying.
Yeah, so
articles
so
about
maybe
stuff.
I don't lament, but maybe we need to rise to the idea that politics is an occasion for people to come to the table. Like you have your ideas, I have my ideas. By accepting the invitation to the table, I have to accept that there's going to be some compromise. I don't know if we set up politics like that. I think currently, it's set up that I come to the table and I shout you all down until you're exhausted, and you just roll over and do what I want.
So, or not, and nothing gets done.
Or not, and right. I'm fine sitting at the table, making sure no one else getting here, nothing gets done.
Right.
So maybe it's a fundamental like reconstruction of what government means when you are at that table. But to the finer point on pork, yeah, I think government based on bribery is probably a bad way to run things. Actually, I'm going to go on record saying that is a bad way to run things.
Can I ask you a question about that, though?
Sure.
Can I ask you a question? I hadn't thought about this a lot, but there are governments run by complete authoritarianism and brute force. There are governments run by bribery. Are there governments run by anything else?
I'd have to research that.
Yeah, I don't know the answer, but like when you say it, just like is there already in existence another way? I don't know. But it's an interesting.
I'd have to look into that. I mean, I always want to look to the past because there are fewer people and fewer special concerns. And maybe those aren't always translatable to our new modern global situation, but I'd be interested in that question. I think, I don't know. I'd look that up. I always want to go back to ancient Greece. They always seem to have their finger on the pulse of democracy.
Now, what if this is about voting?
In what way?
Well, because we're not mandated to vote, you kind of have to get, you're always dealing with the most sort of, not even the most informed, but the most activated group,
most activated, exactly.
The most activated. So you're sort of, everyone is held hostage by the most activated.
As they experienced in Britain a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it is. It's the most activated. And it's not even necessarily the most informed. So we, as Americans, we've never actually experienced a government that's been built around the understanding that everyone is going to be voting, whether they're informed or not.
That's right. Absolutely, that's right.
And so you can kind of play with a group when you know that it's a small group that you're always going to be having to kind of respond to in terms of, like, what you bring home to your voters or blah, 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 right? So maybe maybe that's something that's emerged from that structure.
I feel like you're not going far enough with what you're saying.
So what I'm saying is, like, if this is the government we ended up with because only the most activated voted, what kind of government would we end up with if everyone was mandated?
Ah, there's the question.
Oh, we have to study Australia. They do it, right?
They're mandated? How does that even work?
They're required to vote.
You are penalized, and I don't know the penalty. You are penalized if you don't vote.
Interesting.
I'm really intrigued by it. Like, that issue, on the one hand, like, the libertarian strain in me is, like, people shouldn't be forced to do things. At the same time, like, I do feel like we would have a better democracy if everyone voted.
It'd be a way different country. I think that's what we are seeing with the Trump phenomenon, and that's why Brexit caught everyone by surprise, is that when a certain subpopulation of the country is incentivized to vote, the things that they want turn out to be really different than what the government, the political elite want. There was a fantastic article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about Brexit, where they went to, I don't remember which township or whatever municipal body, but there was somebody that had voted very heavily to leave the EU, and they went and they interviewed people. And surprisingly for the New York Times, it was a very neutral article, because usually they're always looking down their nose at working class people. But they just sort of talked to people, and the things that they were saying were like, well, I heard that the stock market crashed after we voted to leave, but I don't own any stock, so I don't see the problem. Like, and everyone had this very limited view, like, oh, well, you know, they said the pound is worse than the dollar now, or it's going down. Well, you know, but I'm doing okay. I have a roof over my head. Or, you know, and they were like, well, our kids' schools are fine. Like, they were comfortable with the low bars that they have existed in, because that's just the class they were born into and they're going to die into. And so the idea of mandatory voting in this country should be frightening to people like us, because there's a lot more people in the country not like us, and if they were forced to vote, I don't know what the country would look like. None of us do.
Well, I mean, because, that's, you know, it is interesting, but, you know, because we have all these voting rights issues. But think about it, though. The only reason why I feel challenged by voting rights issues is because I know that we are not mandated to vote. And the only reason why, in some ways, I'm even, like, nervous about sort of citizen testing to vote is because I know that that process gets muddied. But to some degree, if you're going to have this responsibility, you need to demonstrate that you are at least informed. Because that's the other thing about the Brexit vote. People didn't understand what they were actually voting for. So but how are you requiring people to vote?
Well, this is the thing, Tricia. You got to back into it. You can't say that you're going to have compulsory voting and then have people prove that they are informed. What's going to happen is if there was compulsory voting, then political people would make sure that the message is clear, right?
That's what I mean. But
all the presentations would be way different.
Or your presentation would continue to be vague and crazy, and you just count on people being confused, even though they're going to be voting. Because that, to me, was the ultimate tragedy of the vote. Like, I feel like the way that we have defined the power of the vote has just been wrong. Because what is the point of having someone vote when you have made sure that they were ill-informed about what they were voting for? That just struck me as very tragic.
The point is for you to stay in power.
That's the point.
It was so tragic, though. Like, when you listen to people who are like, I voted leave, but I only voted for it for this reason. You're like, oh, they didn't see all the other consequences. I just thought, well, damn it. That seemed just, I don't know, just
can I just say my favorite? I saw two interviews with people who said, I believed we should have stayed, but I voted to leave because, like, I'm pissed at the government, and now I wish I voted to stay. It's like, what? You issued a protest vote against what you actually thought should happen, and now you regret? Like, that was the craziest shit I ever heard.
But listen to what's being said there, right? I didn't think my vote would matter because I didn't think that opinion was going to be heard.
Right.
And I think the fact that it was heard is there's a lot of power in that. And I think the working class people, less educated people in Britain, I think this is going to be a call to them that they do have a lot of power, right? What's happened with Trump in this country, right? The fact that Trump and Clinton are neck and neck in the polls should tell us everything about the state of a particular kind of voter in this country.
Yeah, well, right? The fact that Trump routed all these other candidates.
They're being activated, and they will go to the polls to just reach back. In Australia, voting is compulsory, and if you don't vote and you don't provide a valid reason for voting, you have to pay a $20 penalty. If you don't pay the penalty, then they can take you to court, and you can pay up towards $200.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting, given the way we do voting here.
You can bother, you know, we don't want to bother you too much.
Well, apparently the eroding of voting rights has actually been quite successful. They've succeeded in making sure that lots of people of color are left off the voting
list. Well, but now, I wonder if, you know, depending on how things go in November, I wonder if we are going to see lower class, less educated white people advocating for voter rights. You know,
they will. Well,
like I said, like they're seeing now that their voice is powerful and that the elite has been trying to keep them out. And that a lot of black people who less educated, lower income white people may not be fans of. But the idea is that it's really a class war here. Right. It's really them versus the elite.
One of them.
It's them versus the elites.
Yeah, let's not completely buy into the Bernie Sanders platform.
No, which is surprising to hear from his girlfriend.
But... I was going to say, I didn't see that coming from you, Trisha.
But I wonder if that's going to be the next movement for that. Yeah. Like, you know, the people in trailer parks and whatnot, what have you, in the bayous of Mississippi, they're going to be like, hey, wow, we almost got heard.
I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it.
Honey, when you see it, it's time to pack up your fucking bags. I don't want to see or believe it, but I think I'm just saying that could happen.
Fair point. Yeah. But
move to another country when I see it.
Were you satisfied, Jason, with your question?
I think it was really helpful. I think, you know, I always like to have a package solution to run by you guys.
You certainly do.
But this has really pushed my thinking, and now, I feel like I do want to research, like, are there political systems that don't rely either on brute force or
bribery?
I mean, bribery, we're not real. We should be careful with that word because we're not talking about something illegal here, but let's say honest graft. Yeah. Graft.
I'm a fan of calling things exactly what they are, and a bribe is me paying you to get something from you. What's happening.
A bribe would be I'm giving you a check.
Yeah.
The fork is I'm gonna vote for money to go to your district.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. Well, you know, I will say,
it's like
say,
a weird
though,
triangle thing. No, it's like you go to the district, which will please them to vote for you to keep you in power. I mean, you're right. It's not quite bribery because it's not one-to-one direct.
Right.
But
it's graft. I mean, it is interesting. Graft. It's graft.
I will say, though, that in one of the many interviews that Obama is very good at giving, and I think he gave an interview with this guy in his garage in Los Angeles.
What?
Mark Maron.
Okay.
Mark Maron, yeah.
He does like Radio America, is that what it's called? He does.
Yeah, like Mark Khan, I think is, yeah. I know. So the Obama interview. But I think what was interesting is that was a very keen awareness that Obama had in that interview. He said, you know, because I think Mark had asked him something along the lines of what keeps you hopeful when realistically you should feel like run for the hills. Mm-hmm. He says that when and I do have to say that this is something that I think struck me when he was running in 2008 when people thought he had no chance, but yet he knew he did, was that he was saying, you know, I met people every day. I met ordinary Americans and I actually asked them things. And he said, I think the biggest challenge of our government is translating what the American people desire and creating a process so that is easier for it to translate in our legal in our political system. He's like, there's a real disconnect between how people want their world to function and how we're able to execute that. And I think something like graft is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like almost like a systems problem. It's like I don't know, it's really bad. Because I do think that most people, especially think about how the very, very controversial issues, when it comes down to it, most Americans are for gun control, for this, for that. But yet, that doesn't translate into any laws or any sort of a political landscape that makes sense for them. Yeah. How is that even possible?
that's the brokenness of our system. Right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the system is broken. Bernie was right, but
oh god, okay.
But I
love that he just slipped that in. She slips that in at the end. Bernie was right.
I don't know where the fix is. Okay.
So shout out to Trisha's boyfriend. Okay. So we all managed to make a media recommendation in our topics, but let's make another media recommendation, which is something that you've seen, heard, or experienced that you think other people should see, hear, or experience. Trisha?
Well, since I just referred to it, I'm going to keep with this recommendation because I think it's actually really good, and you know, we don't have this president for long, so I think it was an interesting conversation. And so what I was referring to is President Obama What the Fuck with Mark Maron podcast. And you can find that at WTFpod.com. And it's just a really, really great conversation with President Obama sitting in his garage, kind of giving his sweep on his time as president, what he wished he had done differently, how he feels about being president. It's just like a kind of, I wouldn't say it's off the cuff because he definitely had some talking points. But I do think that it's a really thoughtful interview, and well worth a listen. So I highly recommend that. I listened to it a while back, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought to myself, man, he's really just – I love a rational man. And if there's one thing you can say about Obama, he is extremely rational.
You love a rational man, yet your boyfriend is Bernie Sanders. Anyway.
I know. It's true.
I will go next. We've been so heady this entire podcast. I'm just going to make
a fun,
splashy, dishy recommendation. There's a show on Lifetime called Unreal. And before you're like, Lifetime, I have to say, this is not the Lifetime that you know. So Unreal is a show about a show called Everlasting, which is very much like The Bachelor, where a bunch of women are seeking the affections of a suitor. And the show is about the behind the scenes. And it is funny, but it's also very, very dark. It's written by two women who used to work on The Bachelor for several years, and they're not talking about which parts of Unreal is based on actual things that happened, but if any part of Unreal is based in truth, it's very, very disturbing as far as what happens on those suitor shows and reality TV in general. Just, it's all about the producers manipulating the women, saying things like, oh, I talked to the suitor, and he says he really likes you. He sees you in the final two. But he wishes you a little bit more fun. Maybe, you know, I brought you some vodka. Maybe drink some before the next segment. You know, I don't know. I think I think he could be in love. This could be it for you. And the main character is this producer on the show, and what we learn as the show goes on is that she may actually have some personality disorders that lend herself to this kind of work because she's fundamentally disconnected from other human beings. It's dark, but it's fantastic. It's a fantastic show. You will watch from one episode to the next, to the next, to the next. It's in season two now. Check it out. So, Jason, that leaves you.
All right. So this is actually something I read a while back. But so the topic I was going to introduce today, which I decided not to after some pushback from Chris, which was very valid pushback, you know, I question whether if the Kurds were ruling the whole Middle East, would we have peace among all the different factions?
All of them.
All of them.
Yeah, but that was Jason's topic. Would everybody in the Middle East.
But go ahead. I'm just saying there was a Kurd liberated Palestine from the Crusaders and things were much better. But I wanted to recommend this book, which I read a couple years ago, My Father's Paradise, A Son's Search for His Family's Past, by a guy named Ariel Sabar. And this book is about, it's a kind of a memoir, I don't know if it's a memoir, but it's nonfiction. This Ariel Sabar, I think, used to be a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. His father was originally born in Iraqi Kurdistan, Jewish, and in a village that was, I think, about half Jewish, half Muslim, but a Kurdish village. And it's a long story, but when Israel was founded, all the Jews basically moved from there to Israel. It's unclear if they were forced out by the Iraqi government, but it's just a fascinating book, and it's just like a slice of the Middle East that you don't normally see. I mean, we hear about the Kurds as like, well, they're good at fighting and that kind of thing, but like, it's just really interesting the dynamics among Kurds who are Muslims, but they're not Arabs, but living in Arab countries and living with Jews and the interactions and dynamics between those groups and the Sunni and Shiite Arab Muslims. And so, but it's a really I found it a fascinating book. My Father's Paradise.
Sounds interesting.
My Father's Paradise sounds very fascinating.
Cool. All right, everybody. So that was, I think, the shortest podcast we've ever done. We were like, we're on top of it. You know, Jason and I are in a rush because we're meeting a friend for brunch, which Jason has deigned to do because if you remember, he thinks brunch is extremely overrated. The idea of friends getting together for a meal, somehow he wants everyone in the Middle East to sit down, but friends getting together for a meal, no time for it.
Last night, barbecue in the evening, very different from your whole Sunday paying too much for food and being
and drinking and having a lot of fun. You're right. That sounds something terrible.
I'm going to be such a great participant in this brunch in a moment. You're going to have so much fun hearing me bitch about what we're doing in that moment.
Oh my God.
Enjoy. Brunch will be ruined for you too. I will make sure of it.
Well, anyway, I look forward to the... Let's move on past that. I look forward to the time when the three of us can be together and actually do this
me
podcast.
Too.
Live. I think that would be so much fun. So, Trisha, you need to come over to the East Coast so we can get that done.
Yes.
Oh, will do.
Okay. I think there are vacancies in this complex, Chris, if you'd like to look while we're here.
You know what? I'm fine in New York. So, anyway, guys, until next time, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.